You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. I'm so happy to be here with you again. Make yourself comfortable. This is another program where we listen to the real words and get into the real souls and minds of some very remarkable and devout Catholics who accomplished magnificent things and without whom millions of souls would not have access to heaven, who would never taste the ecstasies of the paradise that God had prepared for them who believe in Christ. First, you have to be told about Christ. In this series of listening to the words of these great discoverers and missionaries, we turn our attention to a man who we should really listen to. A man who had a way with words, Hernan Cortes, the conquistador. Now you know the Grand Commission. Go forth and carry the gospel to all nations. Convert them, baptize them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost. That was taken very much to heart by Columbus. And today's subject, Hernan Cortes. We should listen to their words because we have a very false impression of these two men. I call that series on Columbus, Columbus Shock. This will be Cortes Shock. Cortes was a remarkable man, and we're going to hear from him, hear what he really said, because we have quite a few records of what he really said, some wonderful speeches. We're going to hear from a man that accompanied Cortes, Bernardo Diaz, who was a good writer, a common soldier, but he wrote about many of the adventures and misadventures in Central America of the conquistadors. Oh, but that's not all. We're going to even hear the actual words of Montezuma. But let's begin our story earlier, not a little earlier, a lot earlier. There was a statue of the Blessed Virgin, one of the three Black Madonnas, and it was hidden by the local inhabitants of an area of Spain, in a province of Spain called Guadalupe. It was invaded by the Muslims. And as they rampaged and pillaged, the year was 714 AD, a group of villagers took the statue, the small statue, and hid it. They buried it. It was buried from 714 until almost 1300. And there was when a shepherd named Gil Cordero, discovered, was digging on the banks of the Guadalupe River, and he discovered this statue on the site of his discovery. On the site of his discovery, a chapel was built, dedicated under the title of Our Lady of Guadalupe. Now, of course, in this country, we're familiar with the Mexican Lady of Guadalupe, which is named after this place, which is named after this statue. And the statue is still there. It's in the Royal Monastery of Santa Maria de Guadalupe, in Spanish, Reale Monastero de Nuestra Señora de Guadalupe, UNESCO World Heritage Site. Now, this monastery is rich in associations with the New World, where Our Lady of Guadalupe is highly revered in the Mexican Basilica de Guadalupe and elsewhere. Think about it. Many of the conquistadors come from this region. Even Christopher Columbus made his first pilgrimage after discovering America in 1492 to this place. So Columbus made his first pilgrimage after discovering America to here, and he thanked heaven here for his discovery. Now, there is a story, and maybe the story is true, that this statue was carved by Luke the Evangelist, and it was given to Saint Leander, Archbishop of Sevilla, by Pope Gregory I. So when Sevilla was taken by the Muslims in 1712, fleeing northward, buried the statue in the hills near the Guadalupe River in Extremadura. At the beginning of the 14th century, the Virgin Mary appeared one day to a humble cowboy named Gil Cordero, who was searching for a missing animal in the mountains. Cordero claimed that the Virgin Mary had appeared to him and ordered him to ask priests to dig at the site of the apparition. And when they excavated, the priests rediscovered the hidden statue and built a small shrine around it, which evolved into the great Guadalupe Monastery. Our Lady of Guadalupe, along with Santiago de Compostela and the Nuestra Señora de Pilar, became rallying points for Roman Catholics in their reconquering, their reconquista of the Iberian Peninsula. In this monastery, Ferdinand and Isabella signed the documents that authorized the first voyages of Christopher Columbus. Let's put your time boots on. Walk with me to 1528. And the structure looks much as it does today. This magnificent monastery. And we go into the shrine. And we see a distinguished looking gentleman kneeling in prayer. One of us asks, "Look at this man. He's praying and he's so still." And the sacristan says to us, "Oh, this man has been praying here for 9 straight days." "Well, who is he?" "Oh, he's Hernan Cortez, the conquistador of Mexico," the sacristan answers. "He is praying for forgiveness of his sins and for the souls of his departed wife, father, and a fellow conquistador." Our reaction might be that that's appropriate. What we know about Cortez is that he's a cruel and unjust man and has many sins to bring to God, and for which he must ask forgiveness. But doesn't this demonstrate an aspect of Cortez's character that is missed by many? He was a man of conscience. Hernan Cortez, most magnificent and most capable of the conquistador, is also the most controversial. To some, he was the ideal Christian soldier who carried the cross into a strange land amid great danger, incredible danger, and against overwhelming odds. But other people say he's a brutal butcher who slaughtered thousands of natives and enslaved others, robbing them of their land, their gold, and their gods. Thus, Cortez's conquest of Mexico is enshrined in John Canning's book, The 100 Events That Changed the World. The author calls him one of the most ruthless military leaders the world has ever seen. Cortez's image problem and current opinion mirrors that of Spain itself. Historians, even European historians, maybe especially European historians, paint a negative picture of Spain because through much of modern history of Spain, it has been the enemy of the English, the French, the Dutch, the Germans, and those who have the ear of the North Americans. Religion added another factor. For the Protestants of America, Northern Europe, and Spain, Spain represents the epitome of dogmatic Roman Catholic authoritarianism. Protestants and secularists raised in a Protestant culture love to hate the Catholic Church. It's the last acceptable bigotry. And the prejudice against Spain also contains a twinge of racism. Even today, it's said in France, Africa that begins at the Pyrenees. Now, certainly, abuses and cruelties took place in Spain and her colonies, but the same can be said of every nation on earth. There's a very independent-minded historian, Dove H. Prescott, who said this. "The Spanish nation at large could boast as great a degree of constitutional freedom as any other at that time in Christendom." Unquote. This freedom made it possible for church leaders like Bartolomé de las Casas, Antón Montesino, and others to speak out against the real abuses and eventually eradicate them. Enslaving the native population was made illegal in the Spanish colonies by Isabella. It was a long and troubled road, but they did eradicate slavery and made it illegal. If these were really totalitarian societies, news is suppressed and the free world knows nothing of the abuses. Want to hear something ironical? Cortez was born the same day as Martin Luther. That's a coincidence, ironic coincidence. Cortez led half the Western Empire out of paganism into the Roman Catholic Church, while Luther led half of Europe out of Roman Catholicism into the Protestant Reformation. We might say into the Protestant Deformation, which has led to a huge tide of secularism. Now, as the story is commonly told, Cortez and his cruel conquistador brutally deceived and conquered poor, simple, trusting Montezuma and his fellow Aztecs. It's an adventure tale of blood and gore, courage and savagery, treasure and danger that makes Treasure Island, the Indiana Jones movies, and Lost Horizon looks like Sunday school picnics by comparison. But is that what really happened? Does that explanation make sense? Think about it. Cortes left Cuba with a force of approximately 500 men, 10 cannons, 16 horses. By the time he reached Mexico City, the Aztec capital, his forces had dwindled to around 400. He faced the most powerful empire of the Western Hemisphere, an emperor named Montezuma, who, in addition to his regular subjects and armies, had 30 vassals, each of whom was capable of producing 100,000 warriors at the emperor's commands. And they were very advanced warriors. Actually, the number is said to be about 3 million, the size of his military establishment. And Tenochtitlan, which is now Mexico City, was the capital of the Aztec Empire, was without question the most technologically advanced city in the world. And what about that vast Aztec army of an amazing warriors, far better fighters than the Turks, which many of these Spaniards had faced back in Europe? And it was not an army of 3 million savages. The Aztecs were in many respects a very advanced culture, far more advanced than the European powers of the day. So Cortes conquered them, a conquistador. How did he do it? How was it that, having just arrived in Mexico for the first time, with 553 men, no knowledge of the language, customs, climate, or terrain, was able to defeat and subjugate this most powerful empire of the Western Hemisphere? Well, let's take three possible explanations after the break. Stay comfortable. I'll see you the other side. Chuck Coughlin, BreadboxMedia.com.
You're listening to Breadbox Media. Find out more at BreadboxMedia.com.
You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. And you're about to listen to Cortez's actual words in a few minutes. But just a moment. But to return to our original question, how was it that Cortez was able to defeat and subjugate this most powerful empire of the Western Hemisphere with a little more than 500 men? Well, three possibilities suggest themselves. One, Cortez was one of the greatest generals of all time. Two, God aided Cortez in his mission. Or three, there's some facts about the Aztecs that weren't being told today. A fourth possibility could be added, that the Aztecs were incredibly weak or stupid, but you have to reject that out of hand in light of their many accomplishments. This was a major empire. They probably had no equal anywhere in the world. Tenochtitlan had over 60,000 households, or a population of several hundred thousand, much larger than any city in Spain at the time, and a central marketplace in which 100,000 people could transact business. They had aqueducts, watercourses, and a sanitation system far ahead of anything in Europe. And their knowledge of astronomy and mathematics was advanced. They had a very accurate 365-day calendar, a measurement of the length of the year that was much more accurate than anything we had until the International Geophysical Year in my own lifetime. Tenochtitlan was then considered an almost impregnable fortress. It was located on an island in a large lake and could be reached only by crossing a series of causeways with gates and drawbridges. An invading army trying to cross these causeways was subject to spear and arrow attacks from the very mobile Aztec war canoes on the lake. Many of the city streets were canals, and even the houses were capable of being turned into fortresses for defense. So the victory of Cortez cannot be simply credited to superior technology. The Aztecs had nothing comparable to European firearms, but even these were primitive and few in number. Only 13 of Cortez's soldiers had muskets, and only 32 had crossbows, and there were only 10 cannons. During the Spanish retreat from Mexico City, the Spaniards had lost all of their cannons, muskets, and crossbows, and still managed to defeat a vastly superior Aztec force at Otombo. What they were up against was a well-organized empire. The leader was an elected monarch, chosen to rule for life by a council of elders. Schools had been established for the training of those who were to become priests, warriors, or government officials, and the training was rigorous indeed. There were clear classes, stratified, and unfortunately, a well-established class of slaves. They had an excellent communication system held together, consisting of runners on well-built highways. A uniform system of taxation existed throughout the empire, and the legal systems included prescriptions of right and wrong, and featured a well-developed court system. That was one feature of Aztec society. And another feature, absolutely more important, was their religion. Their robust religion, which is in some respects similar to New Age pantheism.
You certainly have run into New Age pantheism. It's everywhere in our popular culture. Sort of a scattered, comfortable, cafeteria-selected, syncretic assemblage of disparate theologies, all cobbled together in the spirit of enormous openness and tolerance. You could say that the Aztecs were extremely spiritual, as is often said of our New Age friends. But what spirits? Not all spirits are good. Some are evil. So what spirits, if they welcome them all in, they're going to have some bad apples in the bunch? As we go on listening here, we're going to find that in that, the openness to any spirit is the fatal flaw of the Aztecs that brought them down. Because in their polytheistic openness to any solution, to any little spirit and great spirit, they had encountered some great spirits and were following them and followed them religiously and devoutly. But were they good spirits? No. Their spirits were so non-good that it brought them down, but for the force of Christ's message. Because in the Aztec religion, they were forced to feed their gods with mass human sacrifices, tens of thousands sometimes in a day. Each huge temple ritual followed by a great orgy of mass cannibalism, the sight of which horrified Cortez and his followers. The temples ran red with blood, literally. Often a historical exaggeration told about other battles, other places. But here it was true. All those beautiful temples, always wet with blood, red and rank and disgusting. That's what greeted Cortez. But it was supported by a well-developed theology.
At the heart of the Aztec religion was a belief in a fundamental spiritual unity of the entire cosmos. What we know about it is, of course, due to the early Spanish missionaries, who were accomplished scholars, and that owing to their eagerness to understand the nations they wished to convert to Catholicism, have left us with first-class anthropological accounts of the Native American culture as it existed before the Spanish set foot in the New World. The religion of the Aztecs was polytheistic, based on the worship of a multitude of personal gods, most of them with well-defined attributes. Among these were Quetzalcoatl, the god of goodness, and Tezcatlipoca, the god of evil of the night sky and warrior of the north, Huitzilopochtli, the god of the daytime sky and warrior of the south. There was a goddess of love and beauty, a rain god, a god of corn, and others. The sun, moon, and stars were also worshipped as gods, and the Aztec emperor and certain high priests were thought to be at least semi-divine. So, of the three reasons I gave, perhaps two, God aided Cortez in his missions. And perhaps three is of great importance. There are some facts about the Aztecs that we aren't being told today. I think I've just covered a few of those facts just this last moment. But let us look then at the character and personality of the man, Cortez. One fact that stands out above all others is his faith and singleness of purpose. Cortez believed he was on a divine mission. He was convinced of it. A divine mission to bring the gospel, Catholic civilization, and the government of Spain to the Western world. One might disagree with his Catholic convictions, and one might be repulsed by a few of his methods of advancing those convictions. But that he believed them himself is beyond dispute.
We shall really fail to comprehend one of the chief objects of the Cortez expedition if we misunderstand the psychology of the Spaniards. Can we somehow catch at this colder date something of the religious enthusiasm that motivated Cortez and his followers? There's nothing in our anemic contemporary life that we can compare with it. The only emotions comparable to the religious zealotry of the 16th century Spaniards are the militant instincts of the 12th century Crusaders and of the faith of the early Christian martyrs. In each of these three periods, indeed at any peak in the religious experience of a race, it is faith, not morals. It is faith that claims the fealty of the strongest men. So it was with Cortez in New Spain. Concerning morals, sometimes he seemed to have no conscience. Faith was the paramount consideration with him. Faith that God was merciful, that Christ died to open,
no, not just open,
to reopen heaven's door to mankind.
The true capital G God, the real God, called for an end to human sacrifice, abolished human sacrifice, when he offered his own body and blood as the ultimate sacrifice, done symbolically with the transubstantiation of the bread and wine into his body and blood,
and that the most abject heathen in the forest of the New World could be saved only if these instrumentalities of salvation
were presented to these native people, were brought to them from a great distance and a great pain and sacrifice. Here's one important way to view the conquistadors. In truth, the Eucharist and salvation were the perfect message carried in very, very imperfect vessels. This is often the way. We had to take the Eucharist to them, to the people.
Cortez believed, as every other Spanish Catholic of his time believed, that the Catholic Church was the only medium by which mankind could assure itself of heaven. There was no hypocrisy in this attitude. He didn't doubt it. His ancestors had died on the Muslim spears for that belief, and Cortez himself would have died to sustain the faith that was in him. The conquistadors were sincere. The legality of the enterprise was guaranteed them by pontifical bulls. They were leaving for a crusade, the one against Islam having ended but recently. Now it was now a question of converting the heathen. They had wept with delight at the capture of Granada, trembled before the Inquisition, and shuddered at the very name of Luther. While still children, they had often spat at the passing Moor. Spain in the 16th century was nothing but a vast monastery, noisy with prayer and bells. They had grown up in the shadow of cathedrals and breathed the odor of incense from their earliest years. Oh, well, we're coming up on a break, so we haven't yet heard the speech of Cortez as he addressed his true believing men as they were about to set out on their very dangerous expedition. This is BreadboxMedia.com.
Redbox Media, now is a great way for you to go deeper with your favorite show or shows in our programming lineup. With our Friend of the Show opportunity, you get extra exclusive content from your favorite show hosts and lots of extra love from the shows and hosts you love. Become a friend of the show by clicking on the link on our website or app menu. Your $10 monthly premium membership will unlock an exclusive world just for you. Support your favorite show today as a friend of the show. Friend of the Show premium memberships exclusively for you with Redbox Media.
You're listening to BreadboxMedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin.
We're listening to Cortez today. We're about to get to Cortez's speech to his men, but just before they set out on their dangerous expedition. And I've just been describing what those men were like, devout Catholics all. They lived in a world so Catholic that we find it hard to imagine in this lukewarm age, this secularized age. It had everything to do with their heroic acts. Christ's great commission of spreading the gospel and baptizing and converting all nations was in the front of their minds at all times. What were they like? The conquistadors, for the most part illiterate men, had no need of letters to feel the same fanatical spirit as did the horsemen of the prophet when they invaded the old Greco-Latin world, or the crusaders when they spread over the Syrian plains, or their own fathers at the reconquest of Granada. They had been told, and they had been very convinced, that millions of Indians would burn forever in hell if they, the conquistadores, did not bring them the faith. They believed this quite simply. Religion was for them not a pretext, but a banner. The existence of God in three persons, the immortality of the soul, sin, the last judgment. It never occurred to any one of them to dispute these facts or even to discuss them. Their confessions were sincere. They just didn't bend their knees at Mass. They bowed down with their spirit to honor God. The worst of them died in penitence. Tied to the stake under torture, they would call out loudly for the last rites. They remained men of the Middle Ages. Religious hypocrisy had not yet been invented. The hypocrite is a creature of the 17th century. Even the foot soldier Diaz does admit, however, that we came to serve God, but also to get rich, and they saw no contradiction between the two goals. Nor do I see a contradiction. I write books inspired by my Catholicism in an effort to spread the gift of Catholicism to other people, but I hope I make money at it. I need clothes and nutrition and shelter, or I would die. There's no hypocrisy here. I want to make the money. I can't just stand there and photosynthesize. There's not enough sunlight in Kentucky, sufficient to maintain a man of my noble girth. So Cortez was religious. He was also decisive. He made quick decisions and readily put his opponents on the defensive. Repeatedly faced with an enemy force that outnumbered him, 200-1, his response is a sudden and successful attack. The third thing is he possessed a keen intelligence. Like Columbus, he had a quick mind. But unlike Columbus, he didn't gain this knowledge through books and maps. He learned it from people and places. He asked key questions, and while in Mexico City, under Montezuma's protection, he surveyed the city with the careful eye of a military engineer. And then the fourth thing, he was an optimist. He had faith in God and in himself, his own part in God's plan. He knew how to communicate his enthusiasm to others with just the right dash of flair and showmanship. Repeatedly, he exhorted his weary men to follow, quote, the banner of the cross and serve Christ and the crown of Spain. It's hard to imagine any other commander in history who could have accomplished what Cortez did in conquering the unconquerable. And so, 1519, February 10th, Cortez stood up before his men, about to lead them on an adventure, not comprehending the glories and dangers that would face them. He had just reviewed his troops, and they gave the first of his many stirring addresses. Listen to Cortez. Soldiers of Spain, we are standing upon the verge of the greatest adventure ever undertaken by so small a body of men. We will now leave the known world behind us. From this time forth, we plunge into a region never before trodden by men of our race or religion. The hazards of this adventure I shall not dwell upon. They are well estimated by the bravest among you. But I speak now of the immortal glory you will bring to Spanish arms and to yourselves. in the successful accomplishment of the mission before us. The shores we shall storm are lined with teeming millions of savages, unfriendly if not openly hostile. We have only our swords and our good right arm to protect us against their overwhelming numbers. Therefore, let no childish strife or inner dissension weaken the front we must present to the enemy. If we go as united, as we go courageously, we have nothing to fear, nothing to lose. But to gain? This, men of Spain, the destiny of heroes. Years from now, in the streets of Seville and Cadiz, men will point to you and say to their children, "There is a hero. He was with Cortez in New Spain." We are on a crusade. We are marching as Christians into a land of infidels. We seek not only to subdue boundless territory in the name of our emperor, Don Carlos, but to win millions of unsalvaged souls to the true faith. By the force and righteousness of our own faith, we shall gain crowns for ourselves in the heaven to come. I have told you that we shall put on the double immortality of earthly fame and heavenly salvation. That is glory indeed. But now I tell you that you shall have riches as well as glory. Be true to me, as I am to you, and I will load you with wealth such as you have never dreamed of. This wealth will not be won easily. But who is afraid? We are few, but we are inconquerable. Let us therefore enter upon our labors so auspiciously begun, and in the name of our God and our Emperor, carry them joyously, confidently, to a triumphant conclusion. Then they said Mass and set sail. If Hernando Cortez could have known in detail the hazards and hardships of the years before him, it is probable that his own stout heart would have quailed as he set foot upon the vessel that bore him to the mainland of America. After about 3 weeks of travel, Cortez and his men arrived at the island of Cozumel, a few miles off the Yucatan Peninsula of southeastern Mexico. I've been there. It's a beautiful 33-mile-long island, and 90% unspoiled. The beach there is littered with Gorgonian colonies, is littered with cast-up Gorgonians and shells, piled so deep you can't see the sand. It's a beautiful place. When Cortez found that some of his men had looted some native villages, he rebuked his men, ordered the plundered goods returned. As Diaz records, here on this island, Cortez began to rule energetically. And our Lord so favored him that whatever he put his hand to turned out well for him, especially in pacifying the people and the towns of these lands, as we shall see further on. Exploring the interior, the Spaniards came across a large stone cross. It is possible this was a pagan fertility symbol erected by the natives, but to the Spaniards it was proof that Catholicism had once been preached in these parts, and it confirmed their determination to win back these people for Christ. Cortez was an evangelizer. He was a preacher. Diaz, who was with him, then wrote extensively about his expeditions, records this event. Many natives of the towns near Cape Catoche and those from other parts of Yucatan came on pilgrimages, annual pilgrimages, to the island of Cozumel. For it appeared there were some very hideous idols kept in a certain oratory on Cozumel, to which it was the custom of the people of the land to offer sacrifices at that season. One morning, the courtyard of the oratory where the idols were kept was crowded with Indians, and many of them, both men and women, were burning a resin like our incense. As this was a new sight to us, we stood around watching it with attention. Soon an old Indian with a long cloak, he was the priest of the idols, went up on top of the oratory and began to preach to the people. In his company, Cortez had a translator who knew the language well, and he learned that the old priest was preaching of depraved things. So Cortez sent for the principal chief, and when he arrived, he told everyone that if we were to be brothers, that they must cast out these most evil idols from their temple,
For they were not gods at all, but very evil things made by men, which had led them astray and could lead their souls to hell. Then he spoke to them about good and holy things, and told them to set up at the place of their idols an image of Our Lady, which he gave them, and a cross, which would always aid them and bring good harvests and would save their souls. And Cortes told them in a very brilliant and excellent way other things about the Holy Catholic Faith. Perhaps you can see what Cortes was like, what he was about, what his purpose was. Fighting was the last resort. The first resort was preaching the gospel. Yes, there's many aspects to this man. He's complex. We must break now. And we said earlier that perhaps God was with him. Well, there were some incredible coincidences. Tremendous gifts of good fortune that were about to happen to Cortes. And we'll talk about that after the break. This is Setting the Record Straight on breadboxmedia.com. I'm Chuck Coughlin. Why not explore the rest of our website? This is webcasting, but the podcasts, the past shows, have some rather interesting ones among them. Take a look.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
You're listening to breadboxmedia.com. The program is Setting the Record Straight, and I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. And you're having the pleasure of listening to breadboxmedia.com. Check out the other shows on our website. There are some pretty fantastic contributors. We were talking about Cortes. Cortes, the preacher, preaching the gospel in South America, only fighting as a last resort. And sometimes the fighting did happen, because fighting was a way of life for these people in the Aztec Empire. So he was on Cozumel. He was attempting to convert the people by preaching from a temple, which had idols of very dark gods there. Well, the priest and the caciques, the chief, answered that their forefathers had worshipped these idols because they were good, and they did not dare to do otherwise. So Cortes himself ordered us to break the idols to pieces and roll them down the steps, and this we did. Then he ordered lime to be brought and the Indian masons. He set up a very fair altar on which we placed the figure of Our Lady, and he ordered two of our party to make a cross, and it was placed in a small chapel near the altar. And the natives seemed very moved by this. And then, in that moment, God sent another sign of his favor. A canoe approached the island, and one of the occupants was dressed as a native but had the appearance of a European. He called out to them in Spanish, "Gentlemen, are you Catholic?" They replied that they were Spaniards, which is the same thing as Catholic. And the man was so overcome at their words that he burst into tears. He asked if it was Wednesday, for he's accustomed to devoting several hours to prayer on that day. And he begged them to join him, sank to his knees, and raised his eyes and hands to heaven. With tears in his eyes, he offered up a prayer to God, giving him infinite thanks. He was Jerome de Aguilar, who had shipwrecked 8 years earlier and had survived. Incredibly, he was a Catholic priest. He eagerly enjoyed the expedition and served as a masterful interpreter, knowing Spanish very well and able to translate it into Tabascan, the native language. So the next day after Aguilar's arrival, Cortes again mounted the temple and spoke to the people of Cozumel in order to inform himself better about the islands. Now that he could better understand them with his new interpreter, Aguilar. He spoke on encouraging them in the veneration of the cross and persuading them to put aside their idols in the belief that this was the best way to get them to abandon soon their heathenish customs and become Catholics. And the priest, Aguilar, preached to them about salvation. And soon the people were so pleased to have had their idols cast down that they even assisted at it, breaking the idols into small pieces, which they had formerly held sacred. Soon there wasn't a whole idol standing. And in each chapel, the Spaniards set up a cross or the image of Our Ladies, and all the islanders worshiped them with prayer and great devotion, burning incense to her and offering partridges, maize, and fruits, and other things they were accustomed to bring to their temples. Such was their devotion to the image of Our Lady that ever afterward, when Spanish ships touched their island, they would run after them, shouting, "Cortez, Cortez," and then sing, "Maria, Maria." Historians who were present record this. Cortez endeavored to treat these barbarians with every civility, as is right and is laid down in the instructions issued by the monarchs of Castile. That is, to offer them peace one, two, and many times before ever making war upon them or invading their lands and taking their towns. So Cortez repeated his offer of peace and friendship, promising them freedom, good treatment, to teach them and to teach them so many things of profit to their souls and bodies. On the other hand, Cortez warned them that if they stubbornly refused to receive and admit him, and he set a limit of that afternoon before sundown for their decision, he, with the help of God, would sleep in their town that night at whatever cost to its inhabitants who had spurned his peace and friendship. The native people laughed heartily at his words and mocked him, and returned their town to tell of the boasting and madness they'd heard. It was a bloody battle, and the Spaniards acquitted themselves well. Bernard Diaz, the historian that was with them and a devout Catholic, wrote this: "I say that all our doings and our victories are at the hands of our Lord Jesus Christ. At this battle, there were so many Indians to every one of us that they could have blinded us with the dust they raised, but for the pity of God." 2 days later, the Tabascans approached the Spanish and asked for peace, and offering 20 women as servants. Cortez agreed, and he preached to them through Aguilar. Cortez told them of their blindness and great vanity in worshiping many gods, and especially making sacrifices of human blood to them. He told them of a single God, the creator of heaven and earth, and whom all men should worship and serve. And they told him how the Son of God had suffered on the cross. These people accepted it and broke up their own idols. Thus it was with great reverence before a large concourse of Indians and with many tears on the part of the Spaniards. A cross was erected in the temple of Pontonchan, and the Catholic men first knelt, kissed, and worshipped the cross. And then after them the native people did also, knelt, kissed, and worshipped the cross. Cortez spoke to them, saying in 2 days it would be Palm Sunday, explaining what that was. Cortez invited them all to come. Well, thousands came, both men and women. And Cortez and his men conducted an open-air mass, in which the natives seemed greatly moved. And then it seemed that God must have reached out, because Cortez was helped once again. The Spaniards, after they departed from Tabasco, again having made friends and allies, with them came the 20 women who were instructed and baptized into the Catholic faith. One of these proved to be a special blessing and a sign of God's providence. They sailed about 100 miles. They stopped at the island of San Juan de Ulua. 2 canoes came out and offered gifts, but they could not communicate. Aguilar spoke Tabasco but was baffled by this language. Then one of those 20 women spoke out. She understood both Tabascan and the language of these people, which turned out to be very close to that of the Aztecs, of whom they were the vassals. This was Marina, a great boon to Cortez. She had been baptized Marina. She was tall, beautiful, aristocratic, and intelligent. With Aguilar and Marina working together, Cortez was able to communicate with these local people. Cortez spoke in Spanish. Aguilar translated that into Tabascan, and Marina translated that into the Aztec tongue for these people. She was smart. She mastered Spanish very soon and was able to translate directly without Aguilar's help. Donna Marino was certainly a skilled linguist, very talented, but she was also a skilled diplomat. She was the daughter of a wealthy chieftain. Her father had died, her mother had remarried, and to secure the inheritance for her son, she sold Marina into slavery and pretended she had died. Eventually, Marina was sold to a Tabascan cacique who gave her to the Spaniards. Lady Marina, Donna Marina, was far more than an interpreter. She was a valuable source of information about these people, their customs, and about the very complex politics of Mexico. She became Cortes' chief advisor, his close confidant, and very soon his lover. And she bore him his first child,
Don Martin Cortes,
who became Commodore of the Military Order of St. James. Donna Marino was a devout Catholic and ever loyal to Cortes. Yet throughout her life, she worked for the relief of the conquered native peoples. Through her, Cortes and his men began to learn more about the Aztec nation and to understand how vast and mighty an empire it was, but also to understand how great their troubles were. And the Aztec religion, they came to understand, to be the source and impetus of Aztec power. And they could also see that it would soon be the source of the Aztec downfall. And in part two, we'll examine some of the later momentous events that occur when Cortes goes to Tenochtitlan, which is now Mexico City, and then is now the capital of that area of Latin America. And he met Montezuma. And we're going to discover new things about Cortes. Was he an enemy of Native Americans? Well, some of them. He went to war with the Aztecs, and he led a force of 200,000. They besieged Mexico City, Tenochtitlan. Of that force of 200,000, the Spaniards constituted about 0.25%. The other 99.75% were Native Americans. So this Native American empire was in a manner conquered by Native Americans. The first terrible encounter of the Spanish with the Tlaxcalans, which nearly proved their ruin, did in fact ensure their success. It secured to them a strong native support on which to retreat in the hour of trouble and around which they could rally the kindred races of the land.
For the one great overwhelming assault, for the Aztec monarchy fell by the hands of its own subjects under the direction and leadership of European sagacity and science. How many do you think would really prefer to live in pre-Cortez Aztec society? How many? For Setting the Record Straight, this is Chuck Coughlin on BreadboxMedia.com. Listen next time for part two of Listen to Cortez. My Listen to series emphasizes the words of the real historical figures when we have them. When you listen to these words, it will be a real revelation to many people how deeply devoted these great historical figures were to their Catholic faith, to Christ's Catholic Church. This is Setting the Record Straight about that. Chuck Coughlin.